May it please the court, my name is Matt Delaghetti. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Mr. Tariq Robinson. We're here today following a September 2018 arrest of Mr. Robinson in the Northern District of West Virginia. At the time of the arrest, Mr. Robinson was located in Fairmont on a federal arrest warrant a search warrant for his vehicle, as well as a room at the Red Roof Inn in Whitehall, West Virginia. The resulting search of the room at the Whitehall, West Virginia hotel room left behind, there were drugs and money found in that room. And about a day later, less than a full day later, there was a bag that was found in that room that by the cleaning.
What would you say is your most significant issue in this case?
Well, there's two issues mostly. The first issue is the denial of Rule 29.
Let's go right to what something is at the heart of this case. That's count 10 business that the government has issued a letter. I don't know how you argue your case, but if you have a government that issues a letter to that effect confessing error, I don't know what you need to say right now until the government speaks.
Well,
at least on that. I mean, if the government's confessed error, what are you going to argue?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to their confession of error on the causation issue of count 10, I think I would like to develop, I haven't had the opportunity at this
point. Let me ask you something. Did they confess everything you wanted?
No.
There's something more you want from that than what was confessed in that letter regarding count 10.
Oh, regarding count 10, Your Honor, I would argue that that even outside of...
Why is this difficult for you?
Well, if it's...
You've got a government that confesses something you have briefed here, and you seem to be struggling saying, good, and let government argue that for me.
Well, it is good that it's going to be vacated,
No one said it's going to be vacated.
Well, that it could
was
be.
Just said they have made the
yes.
confession, and at that point, where's the adversarial position that's being taken here? We have two counsel who I take it prepared to make that argument.
Yes.
There's no independent counsel here.
Yes.
So where's the adversarial process that we now consider on this?
Even if... notwithstanding count 10, Mr. Robinson is still looking at a life sentence. And I can argue with respect to that causation issue. I would like to address the speedy trial issue, if I may.
You don't really think you can get very far on that speedy trial issue, do you?
No.
I mean, I've never seen one, granted, to be honest with you. I'm not saying it doesn't. It probably should, but they've got a good reason here. But, I mean, you've got your brief, you've got the
yes.
argument before us. My question, but I'll lean on Judge Wilkerson and Judge Diaz if they want to go further, is there anything you can add to what you've already said? Because if you're just going to repeat it, that's where we are. I'm trying to be frank with you in terms of
how this case is going. Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor. I wouldn't have anything else then.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Flower.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, I'm Brandon Flower at the United States Attorney's Office in the Northern District of West Virginia. I'll go directly to the issue that Judge Wynn has addressed, and that is the causation issue.
You must know this is the issue
10.
The court has some concern. Otherwise, we would have just sent this on back once you confessed the error. So maybe to further explain why you chose to confess error
yes, sir.
On that account, it is an interesting situation. And I think if I get it down, it really comes down to the fact that you pursued a method of proving it that really was not the theory that should have been used, should have been but cause. And that just was not put forth for this particular count here. So you know, and I know there'll be other questions, but I wanted you to proceed on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor. And of course, right now the government's looking at this from a hindsight perspective, but that is correct. We should have pursued a but-for causation in regards to count 10 and the distribution resulting in
Why do you say that? What was wrong with your previous position? What was wrong with pursuing an independently sufficient cause of death? That seems to the statute talks about resulting in death, and if something is an independently sufficient cause of death, it would seem to me that the supplying of fentanyl resulted in death.
And Your Honor, that's exactly...
And the word, excuse me, counsel, the words, you can't just have any old cause. You can't just have a contributing cause or a peripheral cause. You have to have a cause that is independently sufficient to cause death, to result in death. And the evidence here is overpowering that the fentanyl independently caused or on its own, independently caused death. You had lay witnesses, you had expert witnesses. They all testified. The jury resolved the question. The judge gave an instruction that fairly presented your theory of the case. The instruction followed from the evidence that was presented. It was given to the jury, and the jury decided this. And so it's just odd to me that you could go through an entire trial with this theory of the case and then come up and at the last minute go wobbly and say, we confess error, when there's a mountain of evidence indicating that it was the fentanyl. It was fentanyl that was an independently sufficient cause of death. It resulted in death and could result in its death and result in death all by itself.
Your Honor, I agree with that assessment. The problem is, in the Burrage case, when the court described the two different tracks that could be used to prove the death or serious bodily injury resulting from the distribution of the controlled substance, the court explained that with the independent sufficient cause, there are multiple independent sufficient causes that are required.
What I'm asking you is, why is that necessary? If you have, it's probably stronger from the standpoint of the causative agent to have a single one independent independently sufficient cause than to have five. If you have five independently sufficient causes, the causative agent can get lost in a crowd. But here it's with when you only have two, you focus in evidentiary terms on those two. But if you have one, why do you need another? The statute doesn't suggest it.
No, the statute doesn't describe which drug, how many drugs, a combination, one drug. But it's the case law. It's that Burrage case that explains.
Let me cut to the chase here. Did you have an expert to testify that but for that fentanyl?
No, we did not.
Did the expert testify that the fentanyl alone did it?
No, Your Honor. And that's the crux of it.
Let me tell you what the differentiation is. Court in Burrage made quick. This United States Supreme Court says the courts have not always required strict but-for causality. But in certain cases, in rare instances, still rare, you can use multiple sufficient causes independently. And what it is saying is you're not going to have but-for. You don't need a but-for if you have multiple causes. There's evidence that this young lady had other drugs in the system that could have. Maybe, I don't know, we don't know. But what we don't have, it could have been caused by one or the other. It's not like fentanyl was the only thing. Judge Wilkerson's correct. There's a whole lot of evidence that evidence that fentanyl did in fact kill her. That's tremendous evidence. Yes. What you don't have is but for proof. And that's the distinction. If you had, even if you had pursued a but-for, but you never mentioned but-for, you didn't get an expert for it, it still wouldn't work, whether it's independent cause or not. I agree. The evidence to this court, if, you know, we want to be the experts on it and say, yeah, but-for, she would have died. But that evidence is not in the record that indicate that fentanyl is the cause alone, which satisfies what the Supreme Court calls the strict but-for causation.
And that is exactly the point. It's
unfortunate.
The legal standard and the evidence.
Because it appears as though you could have gone that direction. You just didn't. And it's quite admirable. Recognize you did not.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it's that expert. The language is right here in the Barrage case. It says no expert was prepared to say that Banks would have died from heroin use alone. That's the problem.
No, and I would say
this is Judge Diaz here. I'm sorry to interrupt, but
yes,
and first of all, let me start by saying I really appreciate the fact that you were willing to go back and take another look at this. It's frankly better that far more lawyers do that, because no one is ever absolutely right. And so the fact that you were conscientious enough to go back and reconsider this is to your credit, not to your detriment. So I'll start with that.
Thank you.
But like Judge Wilkinson, I just have a real problem understanding what Burrage has to do with this particular case. I think, frankly, the court might have been better off perhaps giving a but-for a causation instruction. But the reality of the situation here is that your expert didn't use the magic words, but he said, the expert pathologist testified, that the fentanyl was in this decedent's body in sufficient quantities to cause her death. I mean, what more do you need? Barrage was a case where no expert was willing to testify that any of the drugs were sufficient on their own to cause death. But here, although the expert wasn't asked the question, he did testify that the fentanyl was in a sufficient quantity to cause her death. This is sort of akin to the example that Justice Scalia mentioned in Barrage, where you have somebody who's suffering from a debilitating injury, right? And that person then is poisoned. And the court said, well, if the poison is administered to the man debilitated by multiple injuries, it is a but-for cause of his death, even if those diseases played a part in his demise. So in this case, we have the diseases being the other drugs in her system that the expert said may have played a part in her demise. But the evidence is uncontradicted that the fentanyl could have killed her and would have killed her. So maybe there was an unfortunate use of language with respect to but-for or sufficient cause, but however you want to define it, there's no dispute in this case that the fentanyl would have killed her. So I don't see what the problem is.
Your Honor, I think in my review of this, again, the problem was what the jury was instructed, and what we argued wasn't the but-for. The jury was instructed on independent sufficient cause. There was no instruction to the jury discussing how the but-for would work. But for the fentanyl, she would have lived, or essentially the methamphetamine in her system, or the acetylfentanyl.
But there's no evidence in this record that would have been the case. The evidence is clear that the expert said that the fentanyl was in her body in sufficient quantities to kill her. I mean, I don't know if you tried this case or not, but I think that the next question should have been asked, well, with the methamphetamine alone that killed her. I don't know what the answer to that question is. I suspect the answer would have been no.
And Your Honor, that is, in reviewing the transcript, those were the next lines of questions that should have been asked.
Here's your problem with that. The expert testified that the cause of death was a combined toxic effects of the fentanyl and the meth.
And
that's
that does
the
not
problem.
Mean but for.
That's the problem with the independent cause. It's not a but-for clause. It didn't say but for the fentanyl, you know, would have been dead. It did not say that was the only one. He said it was a combined toxic effects of fentanyl and meth. That's the major problem you have in this case, and that's why it presents this conundrum for you now. Because you didn't have that expert say that's only the fentanyl. There are absolutely, the evidence is absolutely correct. It is definitely a sufficient cause. The question is it an independent sufficient cause, which you establish by saying, yes, that solely could have done it as one of the independent. That's the missing element here.
Well, Your Honor, in the case, the expert did say that the fentanyl by itself was sufficient to kill her. But the problem is, from my reading of the Burrage case and the explanation of the independent sufficient cause, it requires, it could have also been the methamphetamine. It could have been the fentanyl. There had to be more than one independent cause.
Has the Supreme Court ever expressly disavowed the theory of an independently sufficient cause? I don't understand why there would be this requirement of multiple independently sufficient causes. If you have one independently sufficient cause, that would seem to be enough. But beyond that, has the Supreme Court ever disavowed the independently sufficient cause of death theory?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. And I agree with your assessment. From just looking at the facts of the case, it seems enough.
What do you mean disavowed it? It's a different type of theory. It makes it clear that it's not the strict but-for causality.
Yes.
It's a different theory altogether.
There are two tracks that the government can prove causation in distribution resulting in death or serious bodily injury, the but-for causation or the independent sufficient cause.
Mutually exclusive?
I think when you look at it, that's why the Supreme Court carved out the independent sufficient cause, because...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Flowers, but when you think about the answer, to follow up with this, how was the defendant prejudiced by what happened here? I just don't, you know, I'm having trouble understanding. Even if, literally speaking, the court didn't follow the language of Burrage, tell me how, in the face of this evidence, the defendant was prejudiced.
Your Honor, my concern is just that there wasn't the proper legal framework for the jury to understand.
That may be. We may have a disagreement about that, but then the question is, okay, assume that's correct. What's the prejudice, given the evidence in this record?
Your Honor, from looking at it as from, say, plain error or harmless error, and I would note that was not argued in the briefs, there was overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt, that the fentanyl caused the victim's death in this case.
Overwhelming evidence under count 10.
Yes.
And overwhelming evidence under a theory that the Supreme Court has not disavowed, and that seems, as far as I can tell, to match up with the statute, which says it results in death. Well, this resulted in death.
Your Honor,
if the Supreme Court had thrown its disapproval over this, that would be one thing. But I don't see that they have.
Your Honor, my concern is it's not the legal framework or that the Supreme Court has ruled that the independent sufficient cause isn't an appropriate theory. It's the way that the facts were presented in the case under that theory, that they weren't presented in a way sufficiently to satisfy the independent sufficient cause when it would have required multiple independent causes. We only presented one independent cause.
Counsel, they were presented in a way that that made it clear this was an independently sufficient cause. I mean, I haven't seen many cases as strong as this. You know, you did a good job. You lined up your expert. He testified exactly along the lines of an independent sufficient cause. You had co-conspirators lining up, and you have somebody carving up somebody's body to throw it into a dump, which indicates he knew darn well what he'd done, and that the China White was what had caused this young woman's death. And it's you you've pursued an independently sufficient cause, which is fine, but the evidence, I think it, because I don't think the Supreme Court has disavowed it, but the other thing is, under any theory of causation, it seems to me that this would be a very strong case. And given the strength, I also asked the good question that Judge Diaz posed. Given the overwhelming strength of the evidence here, we don't generally think of instructional error as necessarily being reversible error. And one of the things you have to look at is the overwhelming weight of the independent evidence for this question. Was the fentanyl a major causative effort, a major causative agent? And if it was, it did what the statute prohibits, to its distribution to result that resulted in death. I mean, this is a serious problem that we have here with this drug, and it is laying waste to communities all across this country. And I just can't see weakening what the statute attempted to do. If the evidence was less strong, well, maybe you'd have a better case. But I don't see what you did wrong the first time.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. And I do agree with you that the evidence was extremely strong in regards to the fentanyl causing the death of our victim.
Here's the question that needs to be asked. How does this change this sentence in this case?
If the government's position is, if the court
vacates
finds error
10.
And vacates, I think the appropriate thing is a lesser included distribution of fentanyl.
But the overall sentence, how does it change it?
It doesn't change the overall sentence, except there would be one less life sentence. Mr. Robinson ended up with, I believe, four or five consecutive or concurrent life sentences.
He has four or five concurrent life sentences. And there's a danger he might lose one of those life sentences.
That is correct, Your Honor.
In what we're dealing with. So there's no real harm. You know, what concerns me, you were the prosecutor in this case. We're not it. And yet, you were the prosecutor in the case. We're not it. You didn't even have to bring this charge in the first instance.
That's
you bring
correct.
It to us, and you look at the fact, and maybe if it had only been the only case, it might be a case you might pursue it more vigorously and says, well, he's going to walk free. This man has four remaining life sentences here. If we simply just vacate this and send it back, he's going to be in prison for the rest of his life. End of the day, I don't know, is this going to happen again? You're going to do this again? I'm thinking about repetition of an error. It would be extreme for us, in the face of the government confessing error, to now collapse these two different theories of strict but-for causality and multiple sufficient causes independently, where there's no testimony for an expert of being alone. It would be extreme, I think. I don't know how we write such an opinion. We can, and you know, maybe we will. I'm just saying, but this doesn't seem to be the case to do it. Because there may be a lesson here, don't do this again. And because it just instructs prosecutors that, you know, you got a case like this, if you only got one, put an expert up to say it's the only one and ask for but-for instruction, that cures it. So that cures the problem in the future. That's the value of an opinion to that effect. And at the same time, Mr. Robinson isn't going anywhere unless something happens with those other four life sentences. Do they run consecutively?
Concurrent, Your Honor.
Concurrently.
Yes.
Well, either way, well, I don't know how you run a life sentence anyway, much consecutive, but if you run them concurrently, he has all those. There's no indication any of those are going away.
That is correct, Your Honor. Unless you have any other questions, Your Honors, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
All right. Judge Diaz, do you have any further questions? All right. We thank you very much, and we're happy to hear from Mr. Delgatti in rebuttal.
Your Honors, I don't really have anything else to present, unless there are any questions.
right. Are there any questions from the panel? Otherwise, we thank you.
No questions, John.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.